From Public Radio International, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Freakonomics had something to do with it, that freakishly popular book that used market theory to spot, for example, the cheating in sumo wrestling. Cheap computing power also helped, making it easy to jam numbers on anything. Crime, movie attendance, AIDS, through an economist's model. Then there were all those riddles out there. Racism, school performance, infant mortality, that the other social sciences hadn't figured out. And suddenly, young behavioral economists, the imperial generation in the dismal science, are on the march, and the field isn't even dismal anymore. The effect of having a distinctively black name, Deshaun or Kiara, is an economist's study now. So is the effect of no-fault divorce laws on keeping marriages together. What the rest of us thought of as the science of marginal costs, the stuff of economist jokes, is becoming more like an art that touches every human choice. The future of economics is next on Open Source. First, the news. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. A radio conversation as broad and deep as you tell us to make it at radioopensource.org. The economist in one of those hoary old economist jokes was somebody who didn't have enough personality to become an accountant. The economic forecaster was invented to make weathermen look good. But those were the reductive old know-it-alls who were always wrong sooner or later. We're talking this hour with and about their young successors, a very different breed, many of them so-called behavioral economists, whose analytical tools now move the game of baseball and family dynamics and public policy all over the world. Pose your puzzle for the economists to solve at our site, www.radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking with a new generation of economists this hour. Diane Coyle in London calls them the soulful scientists. Justin Wolfers teaches business and public policy at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, but his focus is on the family, which gets you soulful right from the start. Justin Wolfers, what are you trying to find out? What are you trying to teach us about the family?
Chris, it's I think just like any other social scientist trying to think about the family, which is why do we form families? How do we form families? Where are we at? There's a lot of political discourse and hand-wringing about the state of the family, but sometimes it's important to just figure out the facts.
Starting where? Where does an economist begin? I mean, Diane spoke of family work, you know, at the core of this thing, but now where's your work?
Diane's absolutely on topic. I think a natural way of thinking about how or why economists get into this is to think about labor markets. So it seems pretty natural to all of us that labor economists should be looking at labor markets. What's going on there? You typically have a worker looking for a job or a job looking for a worker. When they find each other, they're more productive together than they are apart. Well, if you think hard enough about it, that starts to sound a lot like what economists call the marriage market, but what other people might call the dating market. There's men looking for women, potential future spouses. When they meet, they form a household, just like my employer and I have formed a labor market match. And when they're together, they can do a whole bunch of things together that they couldn't do separately. And so thinking about the family as a matching market is actually a fairly natural thing for an economist to do. And then just like in the labor market, you think about, maybe it's more natural in the labor market to think about employer and employee fighting over, do I get a higher wage or do you get higher profits? But whether we like it or not, and however unromantic it sometimes sounds, when a household produces more together than apart, we have to decide, does the husband get to decide what color the car is? How do we divide the fruits of the marriage? And just like in labor markets, it's often determined by things like outside market conditions. My spouse has a lot of good options out there, a lot of potential suitors. Maybe I'll have to treat her a little bit better in much the same way that if I'm doing really well on the job market, my employer might consider giving me a raise.
Diane was speaking about Gary Becker's work on economic behavior in marriages. It's not just a romantic ideal. It's not about motherhood or women or anybody else on pedestals. It's a kind of functioning unit. Where is it going? What can you tell, Justin Wolfers, about the 21st century marriage,
That's a great question, Chris.
The no-fault divorce marriage.
Yeah. Well, I think we've actually seen what a marriage is and what it looks like change dramatically. 100 years ago, just about every married couple, actually 4 out of 5 married couples in the U.S. had a kid currently in the household. So it's pretty easy back then to think that the purpose of marriage was potentially to raise children. Hmm. Today, I think 2 out of 5 married couples currently have a child in the household. So it seems that this idea of a couple producing something, if they're still producing something, that's an economic concept, a child, as the basis for the family, may not be where we're at so much. And so trying to think harder about what it is that families do or what do they produce together. The old notion of families then was actually based upon the idea of a family sort of like a little firm, where husband and wife together can produce more than they could apart. And that was deeply embedded in a lot of Gary Becker's work. I think now that we start to see families don't look much like firms anymore.
Hmm.
Families in the 1950s did look a lot like firms. Think about firms. They're highly specialized, different people doing different jobs. So it used to be, you know, the wife doing household work and the man off doing market work. Well, that's not true today either. And so if it's not this firm-based model, now I hate to use jargon here, Chris, but you might think the new theory of the family and what brings families together is actually something more romantic. It's what economists would call consumption complementarities.
Uh-oh.
But that's just you and I enjoy the same thing. It's really important to me that I take my vacation at the same time as my wife takes her vacation. My partner is my closest intimate. They're the person I share things with. There's a lot of anecdotal work, at the very least, that suggests that today we do, in fact, confide in our spouses, whereas historically we used to confide in our friends. And so it's this idea that what we enjoy doing together or consuming stuff together may actually be what's keeping couples together today.
Justin Wolf, is families as business or business as families? One thing that's fascinating, but strip the jargon away, and it sounds like either very good anthropology or very refined common sense. Where does the empirical data come in? Where does the crunching make it somewhat different than the short story writing, say?
Chris, it's a beautiful time to be an economist because the world, it's raining data on us. And so it gives us a wonderful way of trying to explore all sorts of different issues out there in the world. So if you think, for instance, one of the real shortcoming about being an economist is we're never allowed to run experiments the way other scientists are allowed to. And so, for instance, you suggested before, what about changes in divorce laws? Maybe that's changed the family. It would be terrific if I was allowed to run an experiment where I could change divorce laws in Massachusetts but nowhere else in the country and examine what happened. Well, it turns out, of course, that, for instance, different states in the country changed their laws about divorce at different points in time for reasons that actually look reasonably random. And so the world or the political process or other social processes gave us sort of as-if experiments or natural experiments. And we have huge amounts of data run by the Census Bureau or surveys on domestic violence or incredible crime data tracking, you know, every homicide in the U.S. for the last 50 years, with which we can sort of see whether these phenomena are correlated with things like changes in divorce laws or other sorts of institutions.
A rain of data. I love it. Diane Coyle, are we getting the right feel of what we read about a lot, behavioral economics? Is this the idea?
Yes, and actually behavioral economists do run plenty of experiments posing problems to students, for example, in laboratories and asking about seeing how they respond to them. And as Justin said, there are all kinds of natural experiments too, where one country or one state will change a law and it doesn't happen anywhere else. And as he said, it's raining data, which is a wonderful phrase. His comments just made a thought pop into my mind, which is that firms don't act as much like firms anymore as they used to. And there's a lot of divorce going on amongst companies. The average life of a company has fallen quite dramatically, and the old hierarchical mass production company is increasingly a thing of the past. And that makes me wonder, I'm starting to form hypotheses here about whether flows of information or incentives are applying to companies just as much as they are doing to households. but I can't give you the results of my studies yet.
Who defines the questions? I mean, it seems to me, given, as you say, the computing power and the absolute oceanic data, everything rides on the imagination of the question and the priority of what's urgent in the world. Who's got it down, Justin Wolfers?
I think that's exactly the right question. So the view of economics today is economics not as a subject matter, money, supply, GDP, and so on, but as a methodology for thinking about the world around us.
Exactly.
Alfred Marshall defined economics as the study of man and the ordinary business of life. And when you start to think about the world that way, why not think about someone who's, why not think about families? Why not think about crime? Why not think about the media? Why not think about political science? And these are really the new frontiers in economics. And then, as you say, the questions become vitally important because we as researchers are the ones who get to decide what are the socially important issues that we get to spend time on. And I think one of the really exciting things about being an economist today is spending less time on esoteric questions and more time being able to start with a question that you actually think is socially important.
I'm thinking of the importance, say, of knowing what wins basketball games. But then I'm also thinking of Jeffrey Sachs, who may be, exemplary to me in the world today, an economist, classical economist, and, tenured at 25 or whatever, but who has made a life's work now out of hunger, rethinking markets, AIDS, disease, international justice. That's really putting your degree to some remarkable use. But then how are the other ways that economists of conscience and real imagination frame the question to be solved?
By Jingo, you put up a big example there, don't you?
I'm also thinking of Roland Fryer, a great rising star of the Harvard faculty, who has decided, in another day he might have been, who knows what, a preacher or a political activist, but he's trying to, he's aiming at a comprehensive understanding of the black condition in America through the economic tools. But I'm sure you've got other examples of the purpose underlying this new soulfulness, if that's what it is, in economics.
I think